The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 136.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, so we are here in St. Bart's. I'm at the gorgeous home of Hugh Hendry, my good buddy here, and I thought that we would set up a quick little Q&A about how to set up a portfolio, because I think that's the one thing that most people miss. They get so fixated on what stock to pick, or should I buy gold, or should I buy Bitcoin, or bonds, or something like that, and then they completely forget about how to set up the portfolio, how to manage the money. It's the portfolio structure, and I think that's probably even more important than picking the right stock or bond or anything like that. So I wanted to kind of pick Hugh's brain on that and kind of hear it from one of the pros. So Hugh, thanks for joining us here, and thanks for being so hospitable this whole trip. It's been just, it's been fantastic.
I mean, George, here we are on the eve of your departure. I can't believe you're leaving me alone. You, like everyone else, now everyone is departing and the island is very, very quiet.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it was great, and I'll be back soon. But on this portfolio construction, I mean, how did you do that when you were managing money? Because I think it's just crucial. Or correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not seeing it correctly.
I got handed the keys to a hedge fund back 18 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like 32, 33. I was a kid. And I remember someone wise and close to me saying, "You're like, it's like driving a sports car, but like no one ever tells you how to do it."
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. I have to say, you were very kind in your introduction. I don't know why I'm the best person to ask. And actually, it's got less to do with the portfolio and how you construct it, and it's got more to do with yourself
and how you control your emotions,
with the
right?
Demons in the head,
right?
And I guess in terms of what it is you're looking for. So I'm always incredulous at how, you know, we work hard. Yeah, there's a kind of, if we're fortunate, we enjoy what we do. But regardless, there's always a kind of grind, and we do it. You know, we sacrifice leisure sometimes, you know, to really put in the hours, put on the miles on the clock. And yet when it comes to investing, not from a professional point of view, but from people, some people don't have that luxury. I mean, sometimes the experts can make a right mess of it. But people seem to kind of throw caution to the wind with this precious capital. This capital that you have accrued through your own endeavors has to be protected at all cost. We work too damn hard otherwise. And so that's when it can become a minefield of vanity and a minefield of emotions. And that's where I feel like I've become an investment philosopher.
Whereas
once I was an investment manager, and I can perhaps relate and give some examples from my time as my Confessions podcast series is very much an examination of uncertainty. Like you can go, you as the listener, we publish it on YouTube, you can watch me, and you have the benefit of hindsight. You know what happened 18 years ago, and gold emerged from a 20-year bear market. And what's more, I mean, gold had fallen from what, $800 to in March 2003 to about
260,
250 with the Bank of England in all of its wisdom deciding to sell it.
Yeah. So talk about that specifically, because I think that's applicable to a lot of the viewers or listeners who most likely own gold or precious metals, and they've seen it go up substantially, and you bought it at almost a low, and it, through the next, call it 10 years or so, it went up, but it didn't go up in a straight line.
How
does that work when it goes up and it comes down? And you're in your own mind, you're like, oh shoot, should I sell it? Is it too soon? Is it too late? Should I buy more? I mean, how did you control those demons?
Well, with where we are, I mean, I kind of just started this journey of examining my own kind of zen and car maintenance, if you will, in trying to answer the question that no one could answer. How do you manage these damn things?
Yeah.
And in the podcast series, yesterday, I published the transcript for the December 2002, and next week I'm going to publish the transcript for January 2003.
And these are your writings, to be clear, these are your writings from back at that time.
No. So this is, so I do this audio and visual recording, and then you get a transcript. Now, I don't have to tell you, these transcripts are terrible. Oh. And they're challenged by the fact that we're talking in complexity. We're talking about, we mentioned things like convexity. I mean, what is convexity?
There's no definitions.
The ability to go up many times. These asymmetric. What do we mean by asymmetric? Asymmetric is more likely than not, you may lose 100%, but you may make 10 times your capital. That would be an asymmetric options trade. And through the software of a transcript, it never gets there. So I labor for hours afterwards, and I recommit, and I change it, so it becomes actually like the chapters of this book that I'm writing. That you get to, you don't have to wait until I publish it. I'm publishing after the podcast is revealed.
Right, but so, they're your writings from back in the day.
The touch point is the investment letters, the monthly investment letters. That I was. And typically it was a dear John, I'm really sorry I messed up again this month. And these are the reasons why.
Yeah.
So I kind of started the fund right off the bat. My boss at the time didn't really want me to launch a hedge fund. He's like, oh God, you know, like, you've got to learn. You're a bit like me. You're kind of cavalier. And so it's kind of probably going to be dramatic. You're probably going to do some dumb things. And I've just been repairing my reputation. And now you're going to come in and just mess it all up.
All right. You know?
Great vote of confidence. And sure enough, initially I open and bang, I'm down. I think the first month I was maybe down 5% and the stock market was up 8%.
So how do you handle that? I mean, everyone can relate. Everyone watching this right now, I'm sure, can relate to that, especially if it's not your money. I mean, then it's, I'm sure, just a whole nother level of pressure.
It's your reputation. It is, and of course it is my money, so I have this size. That's my reputation. Well, it's tough. My first child, my son, had been born in the same month, would you believe, that we launched the hedge fund. So it was a lively household. But to answer your question, let's unfold it a little bit. So I'm a bad loser. And so I really felt I was in a dark place. And it was a place of foreboding. The majority of hedge funds fail in that first year. And it's a return to the survivor. And that's why some of these returns can be so fabulous. And I was struck and dumbfounded by, was that a fate, the same fate that was going to befall me?
Right.
And then December came along, and I had this great month. And then January came along, and I had this amazing month. I think we were up 8%. It was the reverse of the first month.
But were you fully invested? Or how did you
do
that?
Yeah, so let's examine that. So, like I said, I've just finished and I've published this transcript, and I want to say we were up 8% and the markets were down 5%, let's say. So 13% kind of like reversal.
But that's for the whole portfolio, right?
That's the entire.
So if you're 50% cash, then it went up a lot more than that with the 50% that you had invested.
No, but I was invested, and I was predominantly invested in gold futures, silver futures, gold mining equities. And then I had currency bets where I'd be long Australia, which is a commodity producer, and I'd be short Japan, which would be an importer of commodities.
Right, okay, so,
and so the terms of trade would be deteriorating for Japan and improving for the Aussie dollar, and that would be manifest in the exchange ratio.
So it sounds like your overall theme was bullish commodities.
It was that I was anticipating a heroic recovery in the.
What did you see back then in 2002 that made you bullish on commodities?
What we saw was the relative performance. So I'm always drawn to things which have had a bear market. Bear markets are devastating. In the context of publicly traded markets, bear markets are all about, you let me down. I had so much faith and confidence invested in the party continuing. And you switched the lights off and you kicked everyone out. I hate you. The price falls 80%. And then, it's not quite as as bad as that, but almost of equal pain is the 10, 15, 20 years of hurt, which manifests itself in no one cares, no one looks at you. Mm. Which is to say, so you have this kind of waterfall and the share price or the asset price collapses. And then it kind of just slowly kind of beats around at the bottom with no one caring.
Yeah.
And that was the position of, in nominal terms, that was the position of gold and gold mining equities back at the turn of this century. But when you then rebased them and made it a relative performance, hey, what's gold doing versus the S&P? And so you look at a relative performance, a ratio chart, then whilst the gold price was doing nothing, it was just kind of bobbing around $300. The stock market, of course, the S&P had just lost the best part of 60% of its value,
right.
And the NASDAQ had lost 80%. So using that as the denominator, suddenly it was a very different picture. Gold was emerging into, you know, the bright-eyed, clear morning of a new day, and with the portent of being a harbinger for a profound commodity cycle. That's what I saw.
Mm.
Those are, you know, I go on about these voices in my head. Those were the voices that were encouraging me to take these positions.
Yeah.
So I did, and I did with my usual gusto. So what was striking, I noticed, you know, in my notes to my clients back then. So after this great month, which really put me back in the ascendancy, put me in the front seat, kind of suggested that I was doing something at long last that seemed kind of clever and important. There's no sense of gloating, because believe me, I'm not shy.
You're only as good as your last month, it seems.
Well, quite, but I'm like, give me a good month and I'm not going to be shy in telling you how good it was.
Okay.
And yet, there's no evidence of gloating. So I'm like, this is odd.
Yeah.
And of course, I'd be writing those papers at least 4 weeks after the end of the month. At least I'd be reading, I'd be at most, otherwise I'd be in the next month. I'd be writing them right at the end of the following month. I always kind of, I need a drama, I need a deadline, and I need the deadline to be expiring in 60 minutes so I could write these things.
Mm.
And of course, by then, four weeks later, the picture was very different.
Mm.
And I was losing lots of money. So, and I think it's kind of worthwhile examining. So there I was, I brought the fund back from the brink. I was now beating the market since its inception. We're only talking about 3 months. This is the mic. You know, this just shows you the pressure. You're measuring things in days and weeks and months.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But I'm back, and I've had this, you know, just making money is good. Making money when everyone else is losing loss is just incredible.
Mm.
So at the end of January, I had 1.3 times the fund invested, which is to say I was
leverage.
Borrowing money. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was 30% leverage. And that's just the long book. Yeah, so that would be the gold and the gold equities.
But why? I mean, why? Number one, why did you want to lever up? And then why 30%? Like, why not 20? Why not 40? Why not 50? Like, what was the deciding factor?
I don't think there's any wisdom that comes from the precision. This is behavior. It's not a science.
Okay.
When the ball stopped and it was going like that at the end of the month, I happened to be 1.3.
Oh, okay.
It could have been 1.4, it could have been 1.2, but it was a kind of, I had taken on some leverage.
Okay.
And then more than that, because the practice is, I had some short positions, and the standard practice is you would then deduct that, and you would converse in your net position, your net equity. I've never liked that, because it's a false sense of security. When there's a profound cock-up, and we're all beset by cock-ups of our own doing and sometimes others. But what you find is your best laid plans never work out.
Yeah, right.
And I've seen it too many times to dismiss it as an aberration, but when you get a cock-up, you find that the stocks that you're shorting, they go up.
Mm.
The stocks that you're long, they go down.
Yeah, right,
and
right.
Of course, it's easy to explain, because everyone's liquidating. Everyone's got the same problem.
Mm.
And so they're having to buy back the shorts. That's why they're going up. They're having to sell their best position. That's why they're going down. So I've always liked to take. So I was 1.3 gross long.
Mm.
And I'd add the short position on top, which was about 40% of the portfolio.
Okay.
So I'm 1.7 in terms of value at risk, things that could kind of go bump in the night. Then, of course, I've got some bonds. And then, of course, I've got some commodity futures. So it's probably like 200-300%, like Delta One, like three times the size of the fund. Why? Why not? I was 32. I'd been handed the keys to a red Ferrari, and I was going to drive that damn thing really, really fast.
Yeah.
Okay. And at the end of January, it kind of looked pretty cool. At the end of February, it looked kind of as if I was going to, like, career off the road, because gold then, probably the great performance that I enjoyed in December and January was the gold price. People looking ahead at discounted cash flows and saying, hey, gold's on a rip, it's on a tear, and it's going to continue. And so when I'm looking at how profitable these businesses are going to be in the future, actually, I'm going to start computing their earnings using an average price of maybe $400. I'm getting bullish. And this is how gold shares end up being fabulously volatile. Like, you know, they move in bigger percentage point daily movements than mere mortal stocks.
Yeah, and the underlying asset itself.
And the underlying asset. Yeah. So if I had 100% of my portfolio in gold stocks, the reality in terms of S&P units, that's like owning five times your fund in the S&P, because the gold shares were vibrating at five times the potency of the S&P. So,
which from an emotional standpoint makes it five times more difficult.
It certainly
the volatility.
Does. And so let me tell you what the manifestation of that is. That so remember, at the end of January, I was 130% long.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of February, that was down to like 85, and I'm going, oops, because February was not pretty. At the end of March, I'm down to 20%. So that's something interesting. So there's an error. I had overcommitted. In my naivete, I had overcommitted. The future was so bright for gold. And it was. At the end of the day, it was. But in the here and now, we had to kind of make amends.
But what's interesting, too, is it's not like everyone was bullish, and all your friends and all the media. You got to deal with
bullish.
You're right. But you know what I'm saying? Is it's still one of those things where if it's that cheap, there's going to be 5,000 arguments as to why it's that cheap and why it's going to be that cheap forever and why it's going to get, you know, why the price is even going to go down further. So how do you, when you see something and it's very clear to you, but everyone else around you is saying, no, that's crazy, that's stupid. How do you filter out the noise, especially when you're down a month and you're really struggling with those internal demons?
Yeah, I mean, you do what you can do. So the first thing is to stop the rot. Right? What is the rot? What are your objectives? My objective was I loved managing a hedge fund. It was like so cool, so sexy. And I wanted to do it today, and I wanted to do it tomorrow, and I wanted to do it next week, and the week after, and the month after, and the year after. And so I had to then kind of scale back and say, well, how do I make that happen? And the first thing, obviously, is stop losing money. Okay. And the easiest way to stop losing money is to sell all these damn gold shares. And that's kind of what I was good at. I was good at being, it's not that I was rejecting everything I believed in yesterday. Sometimes I could do that. But it was just like, this damn thing ain't working right now. And I don't know how, I didn't foresee this blip. And I can't tell you how long it's gonna last. But if it keeps lasting, I'm just digging a bigger and bigger ditch for me to climb out. So let's make we've now got a ditch, okay? Let's make it a shallow grave rather than a deep grave, okay?
Right.
And that's why I come down. Part of what I did, I liken my portfolio as being a centipede. I had 100 feet. I had feet in the game, okay? But so I would have a narrative. We're in a commodity super cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to populate that with commodities. I want to populate it with gold mining equities, large cap names. I want to have small juniors. I want to have some royalties. I want to have the futures. I want to have some silver as well. I want to have the industrial metals like copper. I want to have the derivative equities of those names. I want to have things that will do well, perhaps residential property players in Australia, because their terms of trade are improving. They're going to feel more flush.
In the Aussie dollar.
In Aussie dollar, yeah. And so I'd end up with a portfolio of almost 1,000 little pieces. And what I was trying to do was, if I had to, a centipede can march on 99 legs.
Yeah. All right.
And my point was, like, if, like, the thing that I think is so bad and so corrosive to managing wealth is a best trade portfolio thing, where these are my two best ideas and I'm just leveraged up that way, it's impossible. You know, if you remember the tale of the climber who gets his arm trapped, he's free climbing, he's on his own, he slipped and he cannot dislodge the arm. Who amongst us gets the penknife and just immediately and chops it off? And no one, and of course not this chap either, he procrastinated. I've only got two damn arms, all right. You're going to take a long time before you cut. So, and the longer you take, the kind of more certain it is that you ain't coming back. And we know of that tale, because quicker than perhaps anywhere else any of us would be capable of, this chap cut his arm off, and he's alive today. So I kind of reflected on that, and so I made my portfolio into, it's a bit like that James Frey novel, which I love, about addiction, a million tiny little pieces. I'd recommend that to anyone. It's such a great story. But my portfolio was a million tiny little pieces.
Yeah, but in a way, they're all tied to commodities.
They are, but it was a mere artifice which permitted or enabled me to cut risk, rather than just sitting there saying, but gold's going to go up, I don't really want to. I have trod on the graves of guys that I passed that had the same vision of the future,
right,
but didn't have the capacity to close positions when it wasn't working. My problem is, I can always buy the damn thing back. I'm going to buy it back from a position of strength.
All right.
And I'm weak just now. I'm fatigued.
Okay.
So it's a hard process. But
yeah,
this conversation begins with an error. But thankfully, I always had means of dealing with my mistakes.
Yeah.
And that's key, because we're dealing with the future, right? So for sure, you're going to make mistakes. Mm. So in designing a portfolio, think about not a fail-safe procedure, but recognize that we're all dumbasses. We ain't going to get the future.
Mm-hmm.
Like the best success ratio is something like 58%. So a lot of your time, almost half of your time, is dealing with failure.
You're right.
Have a means of extracting failure from the portfolio. Only then will you get longevity.
Yeah, so that's a great point. Now, you were talking about this bullish commodity cycle, and it seems like we could be in a bullish commodity cycle now. I know commodities are cheap relative to financial assets when you look at them historically. So what do you think about, do you see any similarities between what was going on with commodities then in 2002 and what's going on today?
Yes and no. Without a doubt, the chart formations in gold and silver are like exactly the same as back then.
Mm.
But back then was a portent for a more general rise in agriculture. I at one point ran the largest agricultural equity mutual fund in the world. We had about half $1 billion in the portfolio. That's where the parallels stop. I do not foresee what we're experiencing in gold and silver. I don't see that reaching over into the industrial metals or the agricultural complex.
Okay.
So for me, it's very similar to my mind. Gold is, if you own gold today, you own Apple, you own Alphabet, you own Amazon. You own lots of stocks that begin with A. That was just coincidence. But don't kid yourself, okay? That's what you own. You own businesses which today, and in the future this may be disproved, but for the moment, the crowd believes that these are near operationally flawless, which is to say riskless, entities.
You're talking about Apple and Amazon and Google.
Yeah.
Okay.
And therefore they are the perfect response to the macro risks of our time, which is one of, we are beset with presently modest, it's a modest depression, which is almost 20 years in duration. Mm. And people say that the stock market's in a bubble. I vehemently deny that the stock market is in a bubble. The stock market today is made up of two components. It's made up of this small, very, very small, and very, very few businesses in the world which one could reasonably argue are riskless. And, you know, we've discussed the names. The majority, however, the risks of their businesses are abundantly clear. Okay. And I believe that you have been attracting discussing the advantages of stocks like the oil majors, the Exxons, the BPs, the Royal Dutch Shell, etc. And they're great. That's the other category of stocks. And the profound destruction that has taken place in the equity market. If you were to look at...
I want to clarify that very quickly, because I don't know that the viewers are following your logic there. What you're saying is that, yes, the market's at all-time highs, but it's because of five stocks, or it's because of 10 stocks, or whatever. When you look at all the other stocks that comprise, that make up the market, because the breadth's not there, then it's not like the whole entire 90, you know, other 90% is in a bubble. So you got to look at the individual stocks and then ask yourself the question again.
Thank you for that clarification, because that is it exactly. If you were to go back 20 years ago and you think of the major corporate titans of the age of that time, they've fallen when I was talking to you about a bear market, you fall 80% and then you kind of drift into insignificance. Yeah. General Electric, you know, these oil majors. I mean, I was looking at British Land. British Land is the preeminent landlord of your AAA-rated commercial buildings in the United Kingdom. It's trading at its 1982 price, and it looks like it's going to trade at its 1970. It looks as if it's going bankrupt.
Yeah, did you? I don't know if you saw this this tweet that was kind of I retweeted. It was from Zero Hedge, but it was posted yesterday, the day prior or something. But they said in the past 48 hours that Apple had gained an entire Exxon.
Or another way of looking at the treasury market today is 10 apples. You know, we're measuring things in apples.
Yeah,
okay?
It's
not Newtonian law.
Right, okay? Right.
But that's why Zero Hedge is a very successful, I believe, who knows, publication. It is able to twist a good yarn. Does that mean you should go out and sell Apple and buy Exxon? Maybe, but not necessarily. I could twist or shift or whatever, but so in terms of the, and I will now, I'll try, but in terms of the commodity complex, to my mind, gold is Apple, like I said. And the oil price or the copper price is General Electric or Exxon. They're not going up. Gold can go up or Apple can go up without it having any significance for the others.
Right, yeah.
Okay, and that's why I would reject the hypothesis of a more widely dispersed positive pulse for commodities.
Yeah.
If we keep on the theme of the oils, however, I think you are doing it, providing a positive service in that conversation about the oils. I wouldn't buy the oil majors.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
You know what's interesting that you brought up, and I think everyone should understand, is it seems like if you look at decade by decade, there's always companies that are just behemoths and everyone thinks that they're going to be there forever. I mean, you go back to the Nifty 50 is always the story that we always hear, maybe in the 60s or 70s.
Kodak, like Polaroid, they've gone.
Yeah, and so now when we look at the Apples and the Googles, you know, and the Facebooks, the argument is always, well, these companies, because of X, Y, and Z, they're always going to be here. They're always going to be dominant because no one's going to ever be able to compete with them because of the network effect or whatever.
There's always a compelling narrative, yeah.
Yeah, do you buy into that, or are you like, listen, we always have businesses that people think are never going to go away, and sure enough, if you fast forward 10 years or 20 years, they might be there, but they're now... Apple is now the General Electric, or Google is now the Kodak, or something like that.
Well, for sure, things change. And so things have been very, very positive. The notion of change would be, the conjecture would be that they change for the worse. However, I don't think there's ever been a time when the payoff... And I don't know if there'll ever be a time in the future where the payoff from like really, really getting it right, like Zuckerberg with Facebook, it's not like you dominate, it's not like you dominate Texas or Maine or California, or the States. You dominate the world.
Yeah, right.
You dominate the world. And I don't think there's been a time like that. You know, so if you go back in time. The great wealth accrued to...
Did Rockefeller have that type of...
No,
Standard Oil?
No,
that was just... Okay.
That was... He dominated America in okay. pockets. Now, he dominated for a time the supply, but it was a tenuous domination because the sovereign was really just leasing it to him.
Mm.
Yeah. Before that, the wealth was accruing to railroad. Well, you had a line, yeah. It was country specific, or Bethlehem Steel, or a banking franchise. They were very, very specific to the kind of sovereign franchise. They were not independent, uber sovereign, and stood above. So that's very, very rare.
Mm.
Now, but then there are grades of significance. An alphabet today is simply protected by a network effect. And, you know, it's not doing anything desperately positive and significant in terms of a revolution today. This revolution was many, many years ago, and it's now embedded into all of our lives.
Yeah, right.
And it's charging, you could argue, just a very large rent. And one, at a society level, could say, well, what do we get for that? Because they then have no idea, it would seem, how to... they take this rent from us, which is their advertising, yeah, and they kind of throw it at a board, like electric cars and all the rest of it. So I would say maybe that seems a bit more kind of its days are numbered, whereas you have, let's say, Amazon, it's still encroaching on more and more parts of life and just sort of trying to make our lives more productive, make things easier. I think that process has got longer to run. It has a moat franchise, which is what they're doing with cloud and the protection of that, but there's technological risk. I think Apple has a bit, like, you know, it just has a... It has, you know, like, we like to kind of think that... You know, I've got 5,000 people who've subscribed to the kind of the dawn of chaos, and that feels like an asset. Apple have got 2 billion people that they know everything about. How do you replicate that? So that seems very, very secure.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about your oil thing, I think, is that whilst oil is perhaps not my favourite representation, I think what's going on in the thesis that you explain, and have you whiteboarded that, or you've just kind of, it's been a
just
topic?
As oil?
Yeah.
No, it's just what I do, or what I preach, I guess, if you will, is just to try to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. And you're going to get them right. You're going to get them wrong. You probably get a few more wrong. But if you just stick with that philosophy, yeah, and you kind of just are able to ride your winners and cut your losers, then I think the average person is going to do better just because they take emotion out of the equation. I mean, I have stocks that I've purchased since 2012, and I out of all the stocks I've purchased, I can't even think of any that I've sold. And I don't even look at them. You know, I just pretend they don't exist. And once they get up to a certain price, you know, they'd say the underlying asset quantity, then if it's quote unquote expensive, I'll think about selling it. And if it gets cheaper, then I'll buy it. Now, that could be the wrong way to go, but that's just how I do it. But I realize that that's not, when you're managing money, you've got investors that you have to appease, and you've got a monthly P&L. So it's a lot different way of looking at the world. And I don't suggest anyone do that. I just kind of tell people what I do for myself, just to keep it simple. But I want to, one thing we talked about, and I know that we're short on time here, but I'd like you to explain one thing. And we discussed, I can't remember when it was, but you were talking about the banks giving loans right now at, let's say, 1%, 2% mortgages, 3% mortgages. And they're giving out these mortgages as if inflation is never going to be a part of our future. Inflation is dead. And I think you said that, at some point in time, I'd kind of like to fade the banks a little bit. So, and I don't know if I'm putting words in your mouth.
I think you're putting words into my mouth.
Am I? Okay.
Yeah, let me tell you what I did say.
Yeah, yeah.
I said that the banks are not dispensing loans. And they're not dispensing loans because they are terrified operationally about the great risks of lending into an economy which is beset by two decades of disinflation.
Okay.
And really that shows the flaw of quantitative easing. We're divided, the audience. We're divided into two camps, those that believe that there is such a thing as a kind of natural rate of interest. It's a kind of invisible, it's like God. He either exists or he doesn't. And there are those, and that natural rate of interest is very, very low today. And then there are those who say that 10-year treasuries yield 60 basis points because the Federal Reserve has purchased $11 trillion, and therefore it's a profound and morally corrupt price. It's price delusion, is a false price, is not real, is a caricature, it's a sin on
on you have an artificial bid.
I'm in the former camp, that the 10-year treasury yields 60 basis points today because the Federal Reserve has essentially given banks $11 trillion of collateral. Now, it's not one for one. With $11 trillion, depending on your equity capital, you could have $11 trillion of loans, or $20 trillion or $30 trillion of loans. Now, to put that in context, the U.S. economy is about $21 billion in terms of annual GDP.
Okay. 20 trillion.
So I want to say that since its inception in 2009, the Fed has quantitative easing. Its balance sheet's expanded by about $10 or $11 trillion, which is to say 50%.
It started around $800 billion, and now it's a little over $7 trillion.
I thought it was seven, and then they were on course to add about $4 trillion this year, which would take you up to about, maybe I'm a little bit in the future, but no, it looks as if they're going
to... Yeah, so the government deficit is projected to be over $4 trillion. As far as the Fed's balance sheet, it's around $7 trillion.
Well, the $4 trillion is going to be Fed, it's going to be, sold to the banks, who are then going to sell those securities to the Fed. So I think we're still seeing the same thing, that I think if you tune in a year's time, you're going to see the Fed's balance sheet on present trends somewhere around $11 trillion.
Yeah, right.
Now, the 10-year treasury yields 60 basis points because the banks, the gene which is in its ascendancy at the upper echelons of banks is fear, not greed. Okay,
right.
And they have no desire to take that collateral from the Federal Reserve and extend more and more loans into the U.S. economy or the global economy.
Right.
And that's what I would postulate is why the 10-year is yielding at 60.
Yeah.
And I'd also postulate that quantitative easing and the Fed and its kind of lower, zero lower bound and its kind of communication that, hey, you we're never going to raise interest rates again.
Yeah. And Jay Powell, we're going to let inflation run hot.
But the problem that we have just now is that the Federal Reserve really is looking more and more like the Wizard of Oz, Frank Baum, which, remember, was a political allegory, which was to say that we create this mythology around these institutions that, you know, never fight the Fed, you know, and it's all brainwashing, and they want you to brainwash. But if you look around the curtain, you're like, really? That's what I've been afraid of?
You're right.
Cannot be serious. Right. And that's kind of where I am, in that we're going to be stuck with disinflation, and it might get worse. Most likely it'll get worse before it gets better. Unless they can actually be proactive. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean, like, in Japan, where they're on the 27th iteration, getting active doesn't mean like reaching the 30th iteration.
Doing the exact same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Yeah.
What it does mean, I believe, is actually if the natural, you've got to get below where the market has kind of gravitated to. And so I kind of, like, today, negative real rates in the States have never been lower. They're minus 100 basis points at the kind of duration of 7 to 10 years. I maintain that the Fed has to go negative, like 150, 200 basis points. Get below the natural rate.
Yeah.
If you want to influence the real world, get either... And, okay, so they are influencing it because they are, via convention and fear of upsetting you lot watching this, they are holding rates above the natural rate.
You're talking about the Fisher equation right now.
Fisher, call it what you will. I hate all that science fiction and complexity.
That's what you're talking about. That's what Dr. Lacey Hunt would call it. And I did a whiteboard video on it. But basically,
if Dr. Lacey calls it that, then I'm good.
If they peg that rate, what you're saying, then the real rates are going to be too high. That's the bottom line.
Yes, which is to say that the kind of the market has determined that it's about minus 100. And if you're sitting there at zero, you're 100 basis points too tight.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So
to clear the loans, to get the banks lending, the rates
are
still too high.
To get the mojo happening, you've got to kind of challenge and take on the natural rate. And then everyone throws a hat at him, like, no, you can't do that. Why can't you do that? And even Dr. Lacey Hunt says you can't do that. But I've listened to his argument, and there's nothing. He mentions technicalities. And like, oh, the banks could sue you. But I'm not talking about destroying the banks. I'm talking about reducing the rate to savers to negative levels, like to big negative levels. In Switzerland, what they did was they preserved, because Switzerland's now had several years of negative interest rates. Again, not 200, 300 basis points, more like below 100 basis points.
Yeah,
so it's kind of... Like, they're still kind of pretending.
And
then secondly, to kind of keep everyone on side, they decided to keep they kept lending modestly positive, and they lowered on the, the deposits were modestly kept intact, and then they kind of worked it out via the loan book. So where we are, remember, for the last 50 years, if you had savings, you have won, okay? So the world is split typically, the economy is split into two parts, debtors and creditors. Creditors are savers. They've typically got more money than ideas. And debtors are the opposite. They've got these great ideas. These are the kids that are going to change the world, or not. A lot of them fail, but they're the dreamers. They're the square pegs. It's like the Apple commercial with Steve Jobs. It's the square peg in the round bowl.
The pirates, yeah.
Yeah, the pirates, okay. And the joy and the magnificence of the US economy is it brings them together and we create this interest rate which allows them to transact. And so the creditors, the savers, like parlay and rent some of their capital to the kids who are going to change the world, and they pay a rate of interest for that. And I want to say to you that for the last 50 years, the rate of exchange has been too high, which is to say it's favored or overcompensated for risk, the creditor or the savers class.
When you look at positive real rates.
positive real rates. And you see it most clearly if you take a risk-adjusted chart of treasuries versus equities. Treasuries have destroyed the stock market. Destroyed. Okay? And the return to treasuries is the kind of clearest indication you can find of the return to creditors or savers. Okay? It's been astonishing. The equity market is kind of has got a component of that, but it also reflects the return to the guys who are building things, changing our world. Okay? So to move forward and get us out of this mild depression, okay, we have to turn the clock back, and we've got to start having a cycle which favors the debtors. And punish is not the right word, but it having had 50 years of feasting, the kind of creditors or the savers need 50 years of kind of like, you know, not getting it so good. Okay. Yeah. That's so how I would correct
inflation?
The world.
How do you get that inflation?
The first thing is to say that you get negative rates. So you get to borrow at -3 and I lend you the money and I'm willing. And do you know what? And you're like, but you're a crazy guy. That'll never happen. I'm like, really? Okay. Because the biggest creditor in the world is China. Okay. And yes, the US runs trade deficits, okay? But the rest of the world gives it, America gets the world's savings. And it's a kind of delicate balance, and there's some kind of gamesmanship involved. But China parks its dollars, has no choice. It parks its, I'm afraid, look, Roman, I will fight you on this point till we're very, very old and even more boring than we are. China will always have the compulsion to buy those treasuries because it's pegging its damn currency to the dollar, okay? Yeah. And it's chosen to do that. So the one thing that they demand is liquidity, okay? As a reserve manager of a foreign exchange, the one thing that's very important, if you're going to park your money in dollars, that when there's a great crisis, you will have to sell the treasuries because you'll have a fire to put out domestically, right? And you have to transfer it from dollars back into your local currency. Okay, there was a huge blip in the system this year in March when there was no liquidity in treasuries for like 48 hours.
Yeah, no bid.
That never happens. Okay, and the Fed stepped in with its swap lines and it provided its lender of last resort, its backhaul. You know, this Victorian economist from 1856 who says that's the role of the central bank. You're to credibly step in and lend the money or to provide the liquidity to make that situation go away. Okay, so I think that treasury put that the Fed has established this year is actually worth a great deal. So I would say to you, it is not, first of all, and they call it safe. Look, why do they call it safe? I don't even know what it stands for. It's an acronym for the management of China's reserves. Okay. And they stop telling you how much money they had in treasuries. But sometimes they kind of, they lift their skirt and they titillate you. Like, they're fascists. They're liars, right? I don't care for all this, but Luke cares for it. But anyway. So they're not a hedge fund manager. They're fascist. They're not hedge fund managers. They're not profit motivated. All they're motivated about is the sovereign strength of China and the CCP being the Chinese Communist Party being allowed to in perpetuity to run this thing, okay?
Yeah.
And to make that happen, to make that function, they need to park money in treasuries, and then when the time comes,
because
in
the liquidity, America, not necessarily the return.
Yeah. So it's
not
a liquidity
yield,
preference.
Liquidity,
right. So my point is, America and its debtors, the kind of the you and me, like we're entrepreneurs, we're doing things. I've got big plans. I've got things I want to spend. Rates are too high. The monetary policy is too tight. So let's kind of, having had it for too long, like the wrong way around, let's punish, but let's screw the creditors. And the biggest creditor is China. So why not have negative? I think the market ultimately will trade negative for US treasuries in the manner that it does for European bonds. Now that takes on to another point. I mean, the macro just now is so...
Yeah, because what's the end game there? I mean, my goodness gracious.
What's the end game there, George? We've been
what's
there.
The end game with negative rates?
You
go -5, let's say, in the United States, you just...
If you've been around...
At some point, you can't go any lower.
No. But my point to you, George, is that where if you're able to direct as a central bank, if you're able to kind of... It's like in the swimming pool. If I had an inflatable ball and I pushed the ball below the surface, I'd have to fight the market pressure, which would be pushing it up. But if I push it really down, I'm going to disturb it, and I'm going to change the balance and the equilibrium. I'm going to change the world, okay? I'm going to create loose policy. Policy's too tight. This is Lacey's point. The market is at minus 100 and the Fed's at zero. It's too tight. Market's telling you you're too tight.
Yeah.
The share price of Exxon tells you you're too tight. The share price of General Electric, you're too tight. The share prices of the banks. The bank's reluctance to take the $7 trillion of collateral from quantitative easing and lend it to the real world. You're too tight.
So you think if the Fed was able to go low enough with the negative rates, that would trigger the animal spirits, if you will, so it trigger inflation, and then rates would naturally go up. The market would naturally put rates up, as long as the Fed could get ahead of the curve enough with the negative rate.
Happened all before. So I say, if you've lived long enough, you've seen everything. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you know, Dr. Lacey Hunt is the presentation, the interview he gave on Real Vision in June, I think, of this year. I got to say, stands out as amongst one of the most intelligent piece of intellectual monetary discourse that I have seen in my life. I have had the great benefit of seeing in my life. Okay, and he has a chart in that presentation, which is the real rate. And in the 1940s and the 1950s, it was minus 10. Okay,
right.
That's how we got out of the indebtedness of the Second World War.
Right.
Because
they pegged, just for the viewers, because they pegged the yield curve. And they pegged rates, basically, and inflation was a lot higher than rates.
That's folklore. They would love you to, believe.
But that. How did you get that delta between inflation and rates?
But you had ration, like, so Dr. Lacey Hunter, you had rationing, right? You might want to buy 50 pounds of sugar, and you might be rich enough to be able to afford it and to afford 10 times that, but you weren't allowed to. Right,
so it's from supply. Okay, I got it.
Did they have yield curve management and capping of rates? They had that as a title, right? But the market wasn't pushing. The market was like, we're in deflation just now. The Fed is always a slave and not the master.
Yeah, I think Snyder's actually mentioned that a few times as well. So the viewers, what we're saying there is the curve was kind of extremely low, but the reason you had inflation there was not necessarily long-term market driven, but more so because you had these immediate supply shocks
that were jamming prices to
the moon temporarily.
Forgive me, my bad manners, George. I should allow you to continue. what I wanted to say is, of course, anyone listening will say there wasn't an inflation scare or reality in the 1950s, but in having a potent policy which was very negative, you had a society that was then willing and able to fund projects. And back then, and the contentious point today is back then versus now, but back then those projects were productive, they were GDP efficient, they were productive to GDP. So in being able to offer a very loose monetary policy, a lot of kind of new interstate roads and whatever got built.
Got a big multiplier on that.
Else. And so the economy grew. Okay. Then again, where I disagree with Luke Grohman again, is like we have this very, very fragile slither, right, which is the US economy, which is, let's say, $20 trillion. And we all, and with our imagination, not even with our imagination, the entitlements and the liabilities that we are accruing could be like 10x that, so like $200 trillion.
Yeah.
So, and for sure there's going to be some form of forgiveness, but the forgiveness I would say would be like giving it to the man, giving the creditors negative rates for 20,
inflation.
30 years.
Right, inflation.
Not necessarily, it will be inflation. The first thing has to happen is that monetary policy is actually expansionary. Monetary policy has not been expansionary since the busting of the technology bubble. Or possibly since the busting of the nationwide housing price bubble, which ended in 2006. So for 14 years, Federal Reserve monetary policy has not been accommodative to expansion.
From the standpoint of negative real rates?
In the sense that it's always been above the market rate.
Okay, got it. So positive real rates. I guess you could go negative, but still be above the
it's
market.
It's been above the market.
Okay, yeah? Got it.
So that, first of all, that has to change. And then we kind of, without some form of diktat or regulation, we've got to hope that our society at the aggregate level chooses wise investments, which are enhancing to the productivity of GDP. And good luck with that, who knows. That's a can of worms, because I cannot understand. The US and other major Western nations definitely underinvest in major CapEx projects. Mm-hmm. And I somehow think it's either ideology or it's bad return calculation, because one of the highest GDP capitals, head of capital in the world, is the US. I mean, Switzerland would be very high, Hong Kong would be very high, but the US, I want to say, is something like probably $40,000 per head is your average GDP. And if you can kind of get those people kind of traveling faster, like in California, not spending the tyranny of so long being trapped in cars, if you can kind of, you know, get Elon Musk and get those boring tunnel things or whatever, I spend $5 trillion on those endeavors. Like, when you arrive at JFK, can you imagine, you like, it was London and you just went onto the Heathrow Express, you went down into like a first rate, like modern, expansive rail terminal, and then 10 minutes later you were in the heart of New York.
Bottom line, you're saving time, increasing productivity.
Exactly. So I'm saying, let's do that, and let's pay respect to people like Professor Richard Warner, and don't take the kind of the ability of private sector banks to create money. Let's ensure
for
that
financial assets, but for productive.
Exactly. Let's ensure that they're not generating this unlimited money just to kind of bid the value of this property higher and higher.
Right,
this has been built. Let's build new properties.
Yeah, right. Okay, buddy, let's go ahead and leave it there. I know you got some surfing to do.
It's getting late. I think my surfing ambition, I hit the water yesterday.
Well, thank you for your time. And again, it's been awesome here in St. Bart's. I appreciate the hospitality, and I can't wait to come back.
Hurry ye back, as they say. So yes, it's been great to have you, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.